Seventh case.
Chapter
four.
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 Right. No, I'm lost these.
Chapman.
It certainly is. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Assistant Federal Defender Judith Kennecke, and I'm here representing Mr. Chapman today. The issue before the Court today is whether the trial court committed procedural error in failing to address any of the valid legal arguments that were submitted by Mr. Chapman at sentencing. Also before the Court is the issue of whether or not the Court committed procedural error in failing to give adequate explanation for the very severe sentence imposed in this case of 40 years. At sentencing, Mr. Chapman submitted no less than six mitigating arguments pursuant to Section 3552. These arguments included the low risk of recidivism, including research on sex offender recidivism and his age. We submitted argument regarding his lack of youthful guidance and his personal history and characteristics, which included he himself being a victim of sexual abuse by two family members. We also submitted evidence of strong family and community support, especially important in this case because one of the victims in this case was a nephew of Mr. Chapman's, and yet his family has still stood by him and his community. We also argued the severe collateral consequences that Mr. Chapman is subject to as a sex offender registration, continued stigma, the possibility of civil commitments at the Bureau of Prisons, also the imposition of a term of lifetime supervision, which submits him to continued supervision, polygraph, plesmograph, and continued counseling. Unfortunately, the trial court did not address any of Mr. Chapman's legal arguments pursuant to 3552. In fact, the only individualized reference to Mr. Chapman in the trial court's imposition of sentencing was that this was really his first brush with the law and that he needed treatment. None of these issues that were raised were addressed in any other manner. And these issues were raised both in a sentencing memorandum and in an oral argument at the sentencing hearing. Furthermore, Mr. Chapman also submitted to the court an argument regarding disparity, citing case law with similar circumstances, production cases, where a 15 to 16-year sentence was, in fact, imposed. Subsequent to this, the trial court imposed the sentence by simply doing a rote recitation of the 3553A factors. This sentence, which is a quasi-life sentence for Mr. Chapman, he is 46 years old and has received a 480-month sentence, which will put him at 86 by the time he would be ready for release. A rote recitation of 3553A is not always sufficient, and it is certainly not sufficient when the defendant is likely to die in prison. Because none of the issues that Mr. Chapman raised were addressed, there is no way to tell whether or not this is a reasonable sentence. The record is completely devoid of any individualized assessment that would indicate that 40 years is a reasonable sentence for Mr. Chapman. I have nothing else unless the court has questions for me.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Kennedy.
Thank you.
Ms. Garrison.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. A guideline range of life, of course, renders any sentence that's imposed presumptively reasonable on appeal. And the issues that have been raised by the defendant fail to rebut that presumption. When one looks at the comments made by Judge Gilbert at sentencing, it is clear that it was the nature and circumstances of the offense that greatly troubled him. He, of course, indicated that he had reviewed the pre-sentence report, which is an extraordinarily detailed document that is loaded with a number of aggravating factors. There were three minors in this case who were photographed. Child pornography was manufactured. There was an additional relevant conduct victim who could be identified. And yet there were additional minors who were surreptitiously filmed at the defendant's residence who were not identified. The surreptitious filming occurred during a long period of time from November of 2006 to January of 2011. This defendant, for all practical purposes, ran the neighborhood party house, providing alcohol to minors. He himself was a regular user of marijuana, an occasional user of methamphetamine. The abuse of a position of trust enhancement applied in this case as to a number of the children that were left in this defendant's care. As to one of the victims, the act of filming included this defendant fondling the child as he slept at the approximate age of 12 or 13 years old. And we are asked to balance against this the fact that when the defendant was raised, his mother was ill, and he did a lot of household chores. That's not much. That is a single sentence in the pre-sentence report. It is unreasonable to expect that the district court would have launched into any detailed examination of that particular statement in the pre-sentence report. As for the assertion that the defendant was abused sexually as a child, again, that is a statement in the pre-sentence report. No evidence put before the court on that point. It is clear that the district court carefully considered the arguments of the parties. As Ms. Kenneke points out, the explanation could have been more detailed, but it was sufficient in this case. It clearly, the judge recognized the guidelines are advisory. He recognized his discretion to reject the child pornography guidelines in particular as being structurally unsound, and indicated that he simply did not find them structurally unsound, and indeed has made that finding in previous sentencing proceedings. Under all of these circumstances, the presumption of reasonableness in this case, of this guideline sentence, should require affirmance of the sentence. And unless there's any further questions, the government will rest on the brief.
Well, Your Honors, I would disagree with the government's assessment of what evidence was and was not presented to the trial court. These were not one-line sentences in the pre-sentence report. I would first note that the court adopted as truthful a pre-sentence report which outlined the sexual abuse of Mr. Chapman. I would also note that the government presented no evidence to rebut any of Mr. Chapman's legal arguments for mitigation. Again, we come down to the simple fact that there is no evidence in this record that the trial court considered any type of mitigation argument presented by the defendant. There was no opportunity for any type of adversarial testing, as the court simply ignored these arguments that were made to
it. So then what are we to make? I mean, he really focuses at page, the transcript 19, the bottom of 19, and the top of 20, focusing on the crime and, you know, how horrible it was and how important it was to give education or vocational care and treatment, and then says he's fashioned a sentence that was necessary but not greater than is needed to comply with the purposes set forth in 3553A. So he certainly acknowledges that that's there. He doesn't spell out those factors.
And yet he doesn't address any of the individualized arguments. That's simply a rote recitation of 3552A, which could apply to any defendant. Because clearly in all of these cases, there is a need for some sort of treatment. There is a need for protection of the community. However, there is no consideration in this, in the trial court's recitation of the individualized factor. Most importantly, the fact that Mr. Chapman himself was a victim of sexual abuse by another family member, which would play a very pertinent role in not only his length of sentence, his reasoning, and his treatment plan. I have nothing else unless the Court has questions for me.
Ms. Kennedy, were you appointed to this case?
I was, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
We move to the fifth case this morning.